You are all amazing and important people in Chicago's civic scene. This is a great gathering. I'd love to list every one of your names, but we want to hear from Joe Kennedy, right? So to do that, I'm going to ask Anya Malahan from the Ireland Funds to come on up and introduce our guest of honor today. So please welcome Anya.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and it's so good to have you all here today. Thank you for taking the time to come and have lunch with us. It has been a bit of a whirlwind 24 hours for a few of us in this room. I'm Anya Malahan with the Ireland Funds, as Dan said. We had one of our largest events last night in New York, a huge gala, and a few of us were at that event last night and got the 6 a.m. flight to Chicago this morning to be the special envoy, Ken today. So it's good. Everything worked out. You know, you can't trust Chicago weather. So it all worked out. We got here. We have many of our supporters from the Ireland Funds here in the room today, along with our Chicago board. And I just want to give them a special shout out, as the Ireland Funds cannot do the work that we do without them. So thank you to my committee members and board member. Thank you. If you're not familiar with the Ireland Funds, we are the largest philanthropic Friends of Ireland organisation in the world, and it all started in Pittsburgh in 1976 by Dan Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers and Tony O'Reilly, who was then the CEO and chairman of the Heinz Corporation. Now, you may wonder why these two gentlemen came together to start the Ireland Funds. So it was 1976. Northern Ireland was in a dire state and was the height of the Troubles. Things were not good. In the unfolding violence, these two men had the foresight to see the need to provide a conduit through which the benevolence of well-meaning Irish Americans could contribute towards peace building there. And the Ireland Funds was born. Fast forward 48 years later, the Ireland Funds has raised almost $700 million and has benefited over 3,000 organisations, north, south, east, west, on the island of Ireland. And in Irish communities across the world, including right here in Chicago as well. With the help of our donors, we have changed the lives of countless people. We've worked hard at securing peace in Northern Ireland. We have provided young people with the opportunity to attend university without having to worry about the financial implications of doing that. We've preserved our arts and culture, and we've helped communities across Ireland help themselves. But that strong Northern Ireland connection to the Ireland Funds, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest today, who is a great friend of the Ireland Funds and Northern Ireland. In December 2022, President Biden announced that he was appointing a special envoy to Northern Ireland for economic affairs. And it came as no surprise that that person was Joseph Kennedy III. Special Envoy Kennedy has dedicated his career to public service, including 8 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, tenure as Massachusetts Assistant District Attorney, and service as a Peace Corps volunteer. He draws from this extensive experience to advance economic development and investment opportunities in Northern Ireland to benefit all the communities, as well as strengthening people-to-people ties between the United States and Northern Ireland. His role builds on the long-standing US commitment to supporting peace, prosperity and stability in Northern Ireland and the peace dividends of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a big Chicago welcome to Special Envoy Joseph Kennedy III.
Thank you, Anya. I'm proud of my affiliation with the Ireland Funds and appreciate all the work that this group does. Thank you for being here and thank you for supporting. Welcome to Chicago.
I was on that 6 a.m. flight out of Boston, so we could have collaborated on that one. Dan, not that I'm so thrilled to be back here with the City Club. Thank you, Anya. Thank you. The Ireland Funds have been just one of the pillars of support as I got my feet underneath me. And every time I've asked for guidance, support, anything from the Ireland Funds, you've said yes. You're also part of the reason why I'm here, because I figured if I was doing that and then Sean Kelly turned around and said, come to Chicago, I had to say yes to Sean. So, Sean, thank you for facilitating the other part of why I'm here. But not that I don't love all of you, but when the program came together and I found I could have lunch at Maggiano's, I was like, all in. this was all great, too, and great to be amongst an awful lot of friends. I'm going to get myself in trouble here for a quick second, Dan, but thank you for facilitating this, and great to be with you and to see everything that you've done with City Club under your leadership. You've got a good friend who's a mutual friend of mine who worked with I've got a twin brother, some of you know that, in the Obama administration. The only reason why that didn't take down the country is because of Bill Daley's leadership. Mr. Daley, wonderful to be with you. More importantly for me at the moment, candidly, nice to be with you. Great to be with your son, who's going to hopefully finance a big project for us. So, other Mr. Daley, thank you for that. But Adam Hitchcock and your lovely wife and bride, Sarah, you guys look way too fresh and reinvigorated to have a six-month-old baby. But kudos to you both, and thank you for all you did to make this happen. And as Mr. Daley will tell you, and there's a lot of veterans of campaigns in here, my current chief of staff, who's worked with me on a number of occasions through a number of different races, I think this is his third stint with me. I think I paid him for one job, not three. But he roped in his buddy Mo to help make sure I didn't get caught in traffic on the aptly named Kennedy Expressway on the way in from O'Hare this morning. So, Mo, God bless you and thank you. And everybody else, we love you too. So thank you.
So we hope you... We hope you feel right at home then.
Yeah, flying out of Midway. So there you go. Right.
Yeah, the Kennedy. I'm sorry, it's a little rough these days. There's some more construction.
I know the feeling. Turns out, right? More ways than one.
And we hope you come back too. We were talking about August. There's plenty more to come here. So yeah, welcome. Welcome to Chicago. Welcome to City Club. It's an honor to have you here. And now you're the special envoy to Northern Ireland. Why? Why is that? That's a unique position that President Biden himself appointed you to and created that position. Could you tell us about it and why it's so important?
So one of the great honors and challenges you have is when the first person to hold the position essentially brings about a peace process that has been, ends a 30-year civil war and centuries of strife and then facilitates a Nobel Peace Prize. And people are like, so what have you done? We're like, thanks, right? Cheekiness aside, what Senator Mitchell did was absolutely extraordinary. And he deserves all the accolades in the world that he has received from not just, obviously, people here in the States, but folks in Northern Ireland that recognize the perseverance and relentlessness with which he approached that position. But in my conversations, not just with Senator Mitchell, but with other people over there, what he was really willing and able to do over and over and over again, and he refers to it as over 700 days of failure and one day of success, which is the only thing that George Mitchell ever said that was a lie, right? Which was, it was 700 days of listening. It was 700 days of hearing and validating and creating this space to get different people from different experiences and different traditions, and that felt an enormous amount of loss and pain, and yet love and connectedness for their home and their future to find a way to come together. And what an example he set, not just for Northern Ireland, but obviously for anybody in public service today, of being willing to be relentless in his capacity to listen and to create that space. So the position was created with George Mitchell. It's been held by a series of successors that have essentially adapted to the times and the role, right? There were some early on after Senator Mitchell had that opportunity that were focused on the decommissioning of Impeller military forces and then the stability of various aspects of the peace process. The part that I was asked to focus on, I think, takes advantage of where Northern Ireland is today, which particularly at this moment is on the cusp of an extraordinary economic opportunity, not just for economic development for Northern Ireland, but to really make good on part of that peace process that has lagged, which is that spreading of a peace dividend, right? Northern Ireland is a place today, Dan, where if you've got a college degree or, you know, the equivalent thereof, unemployment rate is zero. It is the safest city of its size in the entire United Kingdom. Northern Ireland is the happiest region of the entire United Kingdom. If I told you that Belfast is the number one destination for cybersecurity investment from U.S. firms outside of the United States in all of Europe, right? It's Belfast. Most folks are stunned. All of those things are true. It is also true that they're wrestling with a history that, if you are the age of everybody but that Loyola table over there, is not history. It's real. It was your childhood. It was your adolescent years. It was what you were trying to raise a family through. This wasn't the stuff of history books. This is what you endured. And so, you know, one of my main points to folks in Northern Ireland is you guys have done the hard part, right? Which is not just 30 years of now 25 years of peace after 30 years of conflict. It was hundreds of years of conflict. But they're at this point where they can recognize that, celebrate that, and take the next step. And for the United States, for me to be able to contribute to that in some small way, that's an honor and a thrill. And as you would expect, you asked my position. President Biden, of course, did a global search to try to find the most talented. I mean, I don't know how it picked it, but I'm glad he did.
Well, so are we. And as Chicago, it's, I think, especially meaningful. We do have, that's why I made it a point to mention a number of the companies that that have a presence there. And it's not insignificant, right? We have at Caterpillar, CME Group. There are so many. Baker McKenzie, I mentioned. Why is it so interesting for U.S. companies to be especially in Northern Ireland?
So I will give you my best recollection of the answer I ask Sarin Gupta, the question I ask Sarin Gupta every kind of couple of months and then try to memorize it and reiterate it. We can probably also ask Sarin, too, because he's sitting at that table. So, but look, I mean, I recognize the fact that as some of you might disagree, but when you're thinking about titans of financial literacy, the former members of the U.S. House of Representatives don't necessarily come top of mind, right? So when you're making the case about where to make a long-term strategic investment, it's one thing for a special envoy to try to make that case. It's another thing to say, hey, there's 1,200 international companies that are doing business in Northern Ireland, 1,200 of them. And this is not a big place, right? It's six counties in the northeastern part of an island. It's about 2 million people. 1,200 international companies, 260 roughly American companies that employ 30,000 people in a population of 2 million. That's not an insignificant number. And so I can go out there and make the case, or what I've tried to do in this is to create the space and platform to say, hear from Sarin. Hear from a company like Allstate that made that investment not 5 years ago, but a long time ago. And let them tell you about how hard it's been to find talent. It's there. Let them tell you about what it's like to recruit people that can help grow your business. There's plenty of them. Let them tell you about, we did a thing back over St. Patrick's Week with two business executives, one from a cybersecurity firm based in Boston, Rapid7, who has 500 employees over there. And you know, an apprenticeship program through Queen's and Ulster University, and they have 60 or so interns, and he hires 15 a year. And he's like, we get a crack at the top 15 people that we then get to review for 6 or 7 months over this internship program, and we're growing like spades. And that continued reinvestment, 70% of the firms that are in Northern Ireland have reinvested in Northern Ireland, right? So there's a very strong validation there. So what I would encourage all of you is, like, come visit. Come check it out. Don't take my word for it. They've got decent golf courses, I hear, right? But in
priority straight.
In all seriousness, like when I've tried to bring people over before, and it's a, you know, I don't have 3 days to go over to Belfast. Fine. You might have 12 hours when you're in Dublin. It's not all that far from Dublin, folks. Right? It's an hour and 45 minutes. You probably pass through London maybe once a year, maybe more. There's a bunch of flights and it's an hour. You can come see a place that is a has an extraordinary history and a fascinating story to tell and learn a little bit about it in a day. It is a day very well spent. And if need be, we'll put you on a golf course too.
Especially because of that last part. But in all seriousness, we have talked about this, that perhaps the City Club of Chicago will put together a delegation to come over and further that relationship and bring some companies that might be interested in investing and also some civic leaders. So stay tuned for that, all of you, because I think that could be a really neat delegation that we could put together to show that strong tie between Chicago and
Love
Northern
it.
Ireland.
Love it.
Please.
So.
Yeah.
I think we have a few attendees already, right? Some validation there. So now that in Northern Ireland, now that Stormont's been back up and running, what are the political priorities for the economy? It's been a rocky couple of months, right? What's the latest there?
So, you know, I would say for Northern Ireland, it's actually been a pretty strong couple of months when you understand kind of where they are coming from, where they are, and this pathway forward. There's headwinds. There's headwinds at a lot of places at the moment. There's headwinds because of some of the political circumstances taking place in the UK, which many of you will be familiar with. There's headwinds on the Northern Ireland economy is more reliant on public sector funds than other parts of the UK. Public sector funding in a lot of governments at the moment is hard to come by. That's all true. That being said, in Northern Ireland, as I said, if you've got a college degree, the unemployment rate is essentially zero. You've got two top-flight universities that are cranking out graduates like crazy that are getting gobbled up by firms not just in Belfast and Northern Ireland, but in Edinburgh and London and Dublin and in the States. You've got this Windsor Framework thing that some of you have probably heard of that provides Northern Ireland a unique opportunity, unlike any other place in the world, that has dual market access, so customs-free access, to the UK and the EU. So you get the best of both worlds. Only place that has it. And you've got a services sector like cyber, blossoming and growing film sector. Any Game of Thrones fans in the room will know that they film Game of Thrones there. They've got a huge studio that they're about to launch and break ground on this summer. So they've got like the fundamentals here are actually very, very strong. What they need is some time. And this, on the one hand, is the hard and unglamorous work of kind of growing that economy, which is you got to win every day, right? They've got the institutions up and running. That is an enormous victory. That's probably a prerequisite if you're going to try to turn around to one of these major, you know, executives in the room and say, we want a $250 million investment. Like, great, but, you know, I brought a bunch of business leaders over to Northern Ireland last October. The reception that we received was extraordinary. They were, people of Northern Ireland rolled out the red carpet and then some. People had a great time. You need more than a great time for 3 days to try to, you know, court a $1 billion investment. But you win day after day. And those days turn into weeks, turn into months, and they've got the fundamentals here. Dan, look, I think the last piece here that has been missing in Northern Ireland for a while, and, you know, calling it out here, is that political stability, right? Where if you've got a choice to make that investment around the world, you're probably, if you have to choose, you're probably going to choose a place that has that stability. Those institutions are up and running now, and it's been about 3 months, and they're still running, which is great. And people say, hey, it's only been 3 months. Yeah, it's only been 3 months, but there were some political shockwaves that came early on, and they endured that, right? And you've got, in that political leadership now, the head of the first minister and a deputy first minister, two women in their 40s, one Catholic, nationalist, one Protestant unionist, that in their appearances very often go up to that podium together and are not shy about the fact that they've got different visions about the future for Northern Ireland, different traditions, different backgrounds, and different ideas about where they want Northern Ireland to go. But they will also say that Northern Ireland is big enough for the other space, big enough for that other idea, big enough for that other vision, and that part of what they're fighting for is the ability for people that think differently to have that space, because they're both pursuing day after day a better future for the people of Northern Ireland. That's not something you hear from a whole lot of political systems at the moment anywhere in the world. And you're hearing it from Northern Ireland. And so I think they deserve to get credit where credit is due, because that's a pretty extraordinary thing.
So you sound optimistic about...
Absolutely. Hugely optimistic. And look, there's a lot of work that has to be done. But they know that. And all they're asking for chances to do the work. So they got to do the work. No one else can... Look, there's... I don't mean to gloss over the history of Northern Ireland. Everybody in this room knows it very well. It's... There's a lot of hurt. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of suffering. There's been a lot of work done to get to where we are. We can recognize that history without being mired in it. You can celebrate the work that they've done while acknowledging there's more to go, and that's a path that Northern Ireland, the people of Northern Ireland, have to walk. There's no amount of U.S. support that's going to make that just disappear and go away. But there is a lot that we have done to help support them along the way. And people in this room, the city of Chicago has done an awful lot to help be stewards of that process. And a big thing, and from one of the reasons why I was eager to come here, was first and foremost to say thank you for the second greatest Irish city in the country. Like, you guys do a good job,
come
right?
On.
Like, that second
on
cheap shot,
flight back to Boston.
That cheap shot notwithstanding. right. More traffic on the highway. Right. What Chicago has done for this region and for this process has been extraordinary. I do genuinely want to say thank you for that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing so much more to further all that work. It sounds like there's a lot more to come. And a whole host of other things that you're up to at the same time, right? I have a whole list of topics and questions and ideas, and hope we can keep going on these different paths. But before I do that, I do want to mention that if anyone does have a question, you do have the little blue cards on your tables. So please just write it out legibly, please, and just give us a wave, and Amanda will come grab it, and I'll weave it into the conversation.
And Dan, look, you know, I was in Belfast like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And look, to kind of crystallize what I just was saying, I land and we go over and I see we have the kind of the formal visit with First Minister and Deputy First Minister, and they're there giving their backgrounds and histories, but saying what they jointly want to do, the priorities, right, on attracting investment, on providing that stability, on addressing the kind of public shortfalls and the financing, and leaning into skills and apprenticeships, and trying to address issues. The number one issue that unifies all five parties in Northern Ireland, oddly enough, childcare. I'm trying to address, because there's 9,000 women with a college degree, and women are underrepresented in the Northern Ireland economy. 9,000 women with a college degree that are not working today. So trying to address that and get more entrepreneurial activity and opportunity. And so we kind of go through the program for the day, and the next day I look at my schedule, and we're going over to this groundbreaking, and this inauguration, I guess, rather ribbon cutting, at this new facility off of Crumlin Road. Some of you will know Crumlin Road. And some American investors have teamed up with, have come together and purchased the building there and renovated it, and it's gorgeous. They got some public funds to help facilitate it, and they purchased a brand of whiskey called McConnell's that was first debuted in Belfast in 1776, good year. Fell on a hard times, there, purchased the brand, brought it back, and put the distillery now inside this building. And it's so significant because some of you have already done this math. It's at the old Crumlin Road Jail, which was a functioning prison up till 1996. So I walk in, and it's beautiful. They've done a spectacular job with it. Meeting space, kind of gift shop, these beautiful bottles of spirits. And the first minister comes in, deputy first minister, a number of their other ministers come in, and I'm sitting there chatting with one of them, and I go, gosh, they've done a nice job. Have you been here before? Which turns out probably wasn't the right question to ask. And the guy looked at me and went, yeah. I spent several months right down there. And he was a member of the Connor Murphy. He's the economy minister. He was a member of Sinn Féin, the political party, and he was incarcerated in cell block A for months, and then after a riot, sent to Lankesh, and he is now the minister of economy. And I, my jaw dropped, and I stuttered a bit, and he went on to say that, but that's what this is all about. It's about the transformation that we have come through, and about the hope and opportunity that we have before us now. And so, some of you also know, I'm not a big drinker. I have now started a habit of making exceptions for Irish whiskey before 11 a.m. because
I sense a stop on our delegation visit.
It's after 11, so I'm like off the court. Like, but if it's breakfast time, why not? But then I did have to pause after that, because they brought us up to one of their tasting tables, and I've got Michelle O'Neill to my right, and Emilio Pignelli, the deputy first minister, to my left, and Connor Murphy a couple seats down. And we're sitting in a place that used to be a jail, tasting the newest vintage of Irish whiskey that was initially founded in 1776 in Belfast together. Which is a pretty amazing thing. If there's one thing to toast to, like, that's it. So
that's a pinch me moment, right?
Yeah.
And a reminder, and what a reminder that this is all in our lifetime. I mean, yeah. This is living history, right? We're seeing it. These, as you said, that man had known that space in a whole different way, and just a reminder that we're right in the middle of it still.
Yeah. And they're working through it, right? Like, yeah. I can't imagine what it must have been like for Connor Murphy to walk through that door. Right? I saw it as this beautiful building. He did not. And yet he was there, and yet he went through it, and yet he did it. And man, right? Like, this is hard stuff, but they're doing it. Right? They've done the hard part. There's challenges to go. They're not as hard as the ones that they've done. So they deserve an awful lot of credit.
As do you. And I hope you.
Well, I had nothing to do with that.
But it'll be interesting, I think, to look back and know that you move things along quite a bit.
I think one of the biggest challenges, and again, not going to be surprised anybody here in particular, one of the biggest challenges that Northern Ireland confronts is a perception problem. For those of you who have run for office in this room, sometimes we don't always think the press reports our activities accurately. I got in a tiff shortly after I got in this position with a well-known outlet, because I said the only reporting they're doing on this 25th anniversary of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement thing, which was getting a fair amount of narrative around it, was bullets and bombs and peace walls and concrete and what happened 25 years ago and the 30 years before that and the 400 years before that. Fine. But, like, tell the story that, like, it's the number one destination for cybersecurity investment for firms outside of the U.S. Tell the story that it's the safest place safest city of its size in the entire UK. Tell them that you can actually afford a place to live in Belfast. And if I drop you down in the middle of city center, it feels like a thriving modern European capital, because it is, full stop. And please, the next time you do a story on this, show a picture that isn't of concrete with bullet holes in it. Because every time somebody does a story on golf, the sun is shining, the sky is blue, and the grass is green. Like, the sun shines in places other than tee boxes in greens. Mr. Daly, the first next picture they put up was of me and President Biden at night. And I was like, that doesn't count. Right? Like, that is not... that's not what we meant, right? But help tell this story, because Northern Ireland has earned the right to tell this story. But we should tell it, because it is extraordinary.
Well, thanks for sharing a lot of that here at City Club. While we're on that topic, Tim Egan, I just got our first question. Asked if we will see a united Ireland in our lifetime.
I don't know.
That's an easy one, right?
Yeah, thanks for that question, everybody. Right. So, look, what I would say on that is there's a process that is outlined in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement about what would need to happen for that to take place. I think you can look at polls of the day that you know, show the trajectory is somewhat moving that way. But there's a long way to go before I think that happens. And that is ultimately up to the people of the Republic of Ireland and up to the people of Northern Ireland to be able to make that decision about whether the future that they want is one that is comes with the United Ireland. What I will say is that I think the lesson that we've seen, or that I've seen anyway, from Northern Ireland today is that irrespective of that outcome, right, or of what your end goal there is, there needs to be a space for multiple ways in which people define themselves. Right? You can define yourself as blank. And we wrestle with these challenges in the United States at the moment too, right? Our issues around identity and inclusivity and how much space there is for people. But that island is an amazing place. We all know that. And it's a place a lot of people call home or draw their heritage to and are connected to. Whatever the outcome there is, it needs to be a place that is welcoming and accommodating for everybody.
All right. I was reading this question when we finished there. Luis from the Senator George Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security, and Justice at Queen's University Belfast has a question here. Some political actors in Northern Ireland are calling for reform of the governance institutions to remove the possibility of one political party being able to collapse those institutions. Do you think reforms would be useful? If so, what should they be? And if it includes adopting a Bill of Rights as promised in the 1998 agreement? Hopefully I represented that question well enough.
Yeah, Luis, I think I'd rather ask the last question again, right? It's a great question, and it's a critical one. What I would say here, and I don't wholly mean to punt on your question, but I'm going to kind of punt on the question, which is to say that I think the Belfast Good Friday Agreement was a reflection of what politics is, the art of the possible at the time. And does it mean it was a perfect document? Perhaps not, but it was a perfect document at that time to be able to get the signatories to come to the table and agree to it and provide the space and the peace that we now see. And so, you know, huge believer in what they were able to achieve. Now that we're here, part of that question is does that document, given the current reality, need to evolve? And there's a debate as to the substance to that and what reforms should evolve, right? That was largely contemplated when there wasn't, you know, an alliance party that has significant political support, right? So if alliance were to win an election, what does that mean? Where do they go? What does it mean for deputy first minister? How do these institutions actually work? There's some big questions there. What I've tried to focus on there without necessarily shining a spotlight on the political reforms that may or may not need to be done is to say we can have that debate and discussion while also making sure that the people of North Belfast and East Belfast and West Belfast have the opportunity to pursue an education that can actually put food on their table, a roof over their head, and their kids can get in a good school that is where the outcomes are shared and that is integrated. And I do think that there is an opportunity now, what I think the First Minister and Deputy First Minister are doing, which is not trying to evade those larger questions, but by saying Northern Ireland is better served at the moment of trying to win the day-to-day challenges to try to meet the economic and social needs of its people, then if we can do that, given what we've come through, given the moment that we're in, let's get there before we start talking about political reforms when our government hasn't been stood up for the past 2+ years. And so those are critically important questions. You've also got the pragmatic piece of, after you start to open up a document, where does that go? And what else gets into it? And how do you then close it? And I think, getting some and providing some pathway and some space here to, as I said before, win those days, win those weeks, win those months, show that things are on the right course, can get you perhaps the space that you need to have some of those larger questions. But I would focus on those for now.
So a bigger picture question that I think can help us lead us into a few other topics. Bill McGrath, fellow Ireland Fund conference attendee and friend, asked, how can the Northern Ireland peace process be replicated or modeled between Israel and Palestine?
So, look, I think there's... how many of you have been over to the island in the past 6 months? A fair amount. As you well know, and for those of you that are following the news over there, right, the challenges in the Middle East at the moment are playing out across the front pages on a daily basis, right? It's salient, it's real, and it's very fresh. Some of you were in Washington for the former Taoiseach's audience with President Biden a month ago. If you weren't there, you would have seen the address. His remarks focused almost, not wholly, not exclusively on Gaza, but largely on Gaza. So this is an issue that is of prime importance there. I think far be it from me to try to prescribe what that process or kind of substantive agreement was going to look like. But what I will say, one of the lessons from Northern Ireland is that the peace that they enjoy today did create space for different viewpoints, different identities, different histories, different visions of the future. Off of a very, a hard-learned and hard-earned lesson that the future here on that land is shared, right? And our future is linked. Our neighborhoods are linked. And victory is not ever going to be able to be achieved if it is defined as the eradication of the other. And that, to me, is the biggest lesson from Northern Ireland. And so, again, politics is the art of the possible. I think you've seen a U.S. diplomatic team with the assistance of other diplomatic, countries and diplomatic officials from around the Middle East try relentlessly since October 8th to try to find a way forward here. And it's been incredibly hard because of what has happened and what is happening. You need to find folks that can help be those arbiters. And the United States had a unique opportunity or unique position given the relationships that we have with the United Kingdom, with whom we enjoy a very special relationship, and with Ireland, with whom we enjoy a very special relationship. And those are connections and identities and histories and heritages that neither one of which were we about to disown. So it gave us a unique vantage point to be able to help shepherd that process. how that credibility can be replicated by some arbiter of that process, and then create the phases to bring people together. But ultimately, there's been people of different heritages living in that on that land in the Middle East for thousands of years. They're going to keep living together there for thousands more. The question is how do we create the political institutions to enable that to happen in peace? But I think Northern Ireland can has a lot of lessons there and can help be a bit of that, can help shepherd that process. And I know they're eager to do so.
Great. Bringing it back home and shifting a little bit to politics, could you tell us more about what you're working on with Project Groundwork and some of the voting rights and the importance of that? I know that's part of and it's something you've been working on for years now, right?
Yeah. So there's my role as special envoy has been obviously an extraordinary honor and privilege. It's it doesn't quite pay the bills, which is fine and great, and it shouldn't. So there's two other hats that I wear. One is as president of this energy company that my dad founded 45 years ago. Some of you are familiar with it, Citizens Energy, but it's now a diversified renewable energy company, a nonprofit parent. We run renewable energy projects all over the country, battery storage, solar projects, some microgrids, and then large-scale transmission lines. And then the money runs up to a nonprofit parent. We give a big portion of our money away. So we support about 130 homeless shelters and food pantries in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And then with regards to the big transmission lines, we give at least, depending on the project, but at least half of all of the profits from each project back to the communities where that infrastructure is built. So it is a way of compensating, but to the tune of tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars per project back to local communities that otherwise wouldn't get a dime without increasing costs to ratepayers. So we're running around the country trying to facilitate these arrangements and agreements and leveraging the unique platform that we have to try to help communities get to yes, because if we need to build out this infrastructure, if we want to not just capture the opportunities around, obviously, AI and machine learning and the technological revolution we're experiencing, but if you want to also adapt to, you know, stop climate change, we need to electrify and we need more power lines and a more resilient grid. So we're doing that. And then I had started when I left office a organization that is doing long-term organizing work in both kind of C3, so nonprofit work, and some political work in places that don't often get as much support or attention. So Alabama, Mississippi, Oklahoma, West Virginia. I've had the opportunity to spend a decent chunk of time in all of those places. They're extraordinary. And the individuals and organizers that are doing this work are extraordinary in the midst of some very difficult circumstances. But again, one of the broader takeaways there is actually a very similar one in Northern Ireland, which is you're not going to be able to... the more distant a political system comes from its people, the more strained and challenged it will become. And I think one of the challenges we confront in our country at the moment is... As we're seeing, with an adage to our old speaker in Massachusetts, Tip O'Neill, who coined that term that all politics is local, as you see all politics become national, and the nationalization of every school board race and every House state representative race and every state officials race because of these issues around the existence of climate change or transgender rights or LGBT rights or religious freedom or whatever, abortion, whatever that thing is, and that all of these things become national, the connection between national and local frays. And when local communities don't feel like they have an agency in it anymore because they get priced out of it because it's too expensive, because they can't afford it, they don't know how to engage with it, you see that fraying. And, you know, on a political left, it's no surprise then that you see, you know, Roe being flipped out of Mississippi. You see voting rights challenged consistently out of Alabama. You see the separation of church and state challenged out of Oklahoma. You see clean energy or the EPA's funds or EPA's ability to regulate climate change overturned out of West Virginia. And there's a reason for that. And there's a reason why that has been able to take place, particularly in those states. And so we're trying to do some very, very base level work to increase civic engagement, increase community organizing on a wide variety of issues, but much more focused on the people rather than the prescriptive outcome. But trying to get people in community engaged again, which, again, is a lesson from Northern Ireland. What the reason why there are so many signatories to that Good Friday Agreement? Because in a fractured society, you needed to have people that represented different communities be able to say your voice was heard in that agreement. And you had a seat at that table. And building upon that support to try to spread that peace dividend out, but then make the space available for more and more people to engage. So, consistent themes.
Got a few things going on, huh?
Yeah, and lunch here. So, like, again, 6 a.m. flight is normally something I'd like, but Maggiano's is, I mean, never disappoints, right?
Well, I'd like to hit quickly on a few things because we're getting there towards the end here. Presidential race. And with a small subset, you know it's coming, right? What do you what effect do you think your uncle might have on the race? It's the City Club.
There's times that I really wish I could be in Northern Ireland and like. That would be one of them. Take back all those nice things. Look, I think, and there's, I got to walk a little bit of a line here because I'm here as a special envoy thing and the Hatch Act applies and all the rest of it. But let me say this. I think there's a lot at stake in this election. I think that the realities of the structures of this race are that there's two people that have the ability to win this election. And that the candidate that I think has the values, the vision, and has demonstrated the extraordinary capacity to deliver in the midst of some very challenging circumstances, one of the most transformative legislative periods that we've seen in modern American history, that President Biden deserves re-election. I think he's earned re-election. And I don't say that just for what he has done, but for what I think still needs to be done and needs to do. And Dan, look, this is there's a lot of friends of my family in this room today. This is hard, right? Our family's gone through we've enjoyed big successes. We've enjoyed, we've confronted some pretty tough things. And the one thing that we always have is family. There's one thing that you can go back to, no matter what happens. You got that rock, right? And so this is hard, right? There's just no doubt about that. I love my uncle. I love his kids. I love his family. Still do, still will. That ain't changing. But when I look at the values and policies that Joe Biden puts forward and the risk of what I think is at stake in this election, it's clear to me that there's it's clear to me that why I'm supporting him and you know, my uncle has his ability to make his own choice, but we disagree on what that should be.
So speaking of family, this is a question from Dan Gibbons. Oh, that's me. How is your grandma?
Grandma's great. Grandma, many of you also know her. 96 as of just shy of a month ago. Talked to her yesterday. I think my aunt Paca dialed me by accident, but she was with grandma, and then grandma got up on the phone, and I had our two kids, Ellie and James, 6 and 8, screaming for grandma in the background. She was screaming for them. So, like, you know, she's doing great. And she's been down on the Cape. She's surrounded by a whole bunch of folks and, you know, doing well. I saw her a couple of months ago now. Grandma still has a way of, like, throwing that fastball high and tight, which, like, Like, grandma, wow. So she's great. Thank you for asking. But she's good.
Yeah, thank you. I had the good fortune of sailing and dinner at the compound in Hyannisport, and I got to sit next to Ethel, to your grandma, and she talked about Bill, where everyone, she was pointing around to the different houses and seats and saying that's where Bobby was when Dick Daly called to say that he delivered Chicago, and that's where, and Jack was sleeping over there, and I'm just sitting here as a Southside kid from Chicago. This is history. This is amazing. Yeah. And I'll cherish that for the rest of my life. But just to, she's such a national treasure, and she's been through so much, and just such a beautiful woman. Please, I'll ask you to do one thing and share our greetings from Chicago with her next time you talk.
I definitely will.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, we're a little over. I got two quick ones. One question we'd like to ask most, really anyone who's been on this stage lately, since we had this U.S. Surgeon General, Vic Murthy, I think you know who that is. He came and talked here about mental health. And we're just bringing that issue to the surface so much more than it has been. In fact, your cousin Patrick is going to come keep an eye out for an invitation. He's going to be coming in June, I believe, Peter O'Brien, and his work at the Kennedy Forum. So mental health, you're around the world. You've got little kids. You've got people. You've got global issues. You've got issues. You've got little.
I got lots of issues.
You got, yes. How do you deal with your own mental health?
You know, that's a great question. And probably in true Irish fashion, I haven't thought about it a whole lot, right? Which, not probably unique in this room. But, you know, look, I think one of the challenges that some of us in this room will share, many of us have shared, but that I do share, is young kids. Because it's chaos every day. But it's a type of chaos that is a uniquely grounding experience, right? Because they don't care who... They don't care who your first minister is. They don't care if you saw the president. They don't care if you're going on some fancy plane or not. They care, great, you went someplace. Did you bring me back something? Can I eat it? What else? Like, when's the next trip we can go on? What are you going to bring me then? And without question, the first question I'm going to get back when I get home tonight is, what did you bring me? Right? And so there's, like, it's just... that. And they are relentless. They are dogged. They are determined that I am not allowed to set foot outside the house without bringing them something. So, which I perpetually disappoint them. But nevertheless, they keep trying. But, you know, we'll have 4 sporting events this weekend. I try to make sure I'm back and home for them every weekend. It is hard, yes, with the varying commitments and responsibilities. That being said, you, as we all have to, you have to make choices about the things that you're just not going to miss. And does it mean you miss other things? Sure. But I am still at the unique space in this journey with them, 6 and 8, where they still like me. They don't think I'm cool anymore, but they still like me. And that won't last forever from what I'm told. So if I can... be there for that part of it, then that's the thing I want to do. The other part, Dan, again, not going to be a surprise for anybody in this room. Since leaving office, I spend much less time on social media. And that has been a godsend. Because particularly if you're an elected official, particularly if you're in the midst of a race, which for me at that point at the end was obviously a Senate race, where we couldn't campaign because it was the middle of COVID and you couldn't get into a room with people. So the only thing you could do is try to campaign online. And when, in the midst of all of that, the lowest common denominator is what was the nastiest thing that somebody will say about you without any form of accountability. And if it's particularly nasty, it will then get liked and shared around social media, that's a race to the bottom pretty quickly. But then that's the atmosphere that you spend all day in. And that's what, you know, your work day is defined by. So that was pretty grim. So the idea of like not marinating in that all day, so much better.
Sounds good.
Little kids, great. X, not so great. You probably knew that, but like that's what I would say.
All right. Little kids, Peace Corps, Harvard, congressman, ran for Senate, international experience. What's next?
Dinner, right? Like, and look, I say that without, you know, my father-in-law, some of you have met, is a minister, and he always had that wise saying of, we make plans and God laughs, right? Like, who knows? What I do know is, I hope there's, you know, I got time in front of me to figure it out. When I left office, obviously, you know, it wasn't exactly what I intended. Quality of life, again, not going to surprise a whole lot of folks in this room. Quality of life outside that world at the moment is a hell of a lot better than the quality of life in it, which is too bad, but it's true. And you're seeing a lot of folks that I serve with leave because the environment there is not one that is conducive to long-term happiness. And so people are serving their time and moving on because they just have to. But, you know, I'm busy at the moment. I get a chance to address. I have the extraordinary honor of being able to work on a series of difficult issues in a place that is unique and that I, you know, have deep affinity for, that I think a lot of folks in this room share, for an administration and a president that I admire. I have the chance of working at a nonprofit that I think is tackling one of the biggest issues in our country at the moment about how do we help make sure that not only do we continue momentum on an economic change or a transformation around climate change, but how do we do that in a way that it doesn't leave low-income families behind? And we're at the forefront of that. And we could take on some of these larger challenges that I think wrestle with our democracy in terms of adequate representation, about making sure that our citizenry has agency and has a way to make sure that their voice is heard and believes that it is heard. Because when it doesn't, that's where you start to get that polarization and that strife. And people, not those institutions, start to erode. And that is a long-term, very hard challenge that doesn't end. But being able to kind of try to help that catalyze that effort and that movement means that I've got plenty of things on my plate that is interesting and fulfilling. And, you know, when I'm lucky, somebody invites me to Maggiano's and I can hop on a plane and get here. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
I could do this. I could do this all day. I'd get in trouble. We have to get you back to the second best Irish American city. thank you. Thank
somebody
you,
just take a sock.
Yeah,
swipe.
That was. How could you?
Okay,
how
so
could
like,
you leave without one? Without
all,
one.
Okay, 17-0, pal. Right. Like, I mean, come on. Right? I left that part out, but if you're going to go there, we're going to go there. I will say, I still got a Cubs T-shirt from when I had one of my best buddies from law school. A couple of them are actually, three of them live in Chicago. And we went out to Wrigley about 10 or 15 years ago, and it was one of those just bright blue sky days. And watching the game at Wrigley is just a treat, right? An absolute treat. So
it's always bright and sunny on the south side at the White Sox stadium. I'll tell you that much. No, thank you, really. Special Envoy Joe Kennedy, next generation, amazing leader. Thank you for being here.